Hi. I want to start by telling you all that you can interrupt me at any moment and ask a question, and possibly we could have a small conversation. I haven't really given my subject matter much thought, really, about what is wrong with the arts, but I have some stories that I can tell you that encapsulate what I think the situation is out there. And the I'll begin by telling you that the woman that I live with has been working with the Seattle Arts Council on getting funding for a performance, circus performance with some trapeze artists. And there's a granting cycles that the city provides for artists and performers and literary people in town. And you find out by going to these arts organizations when the funding cycles begin and end and what you need to prepare for asking the city, the state, or the federal government for money. And as artists, a lot of us at a certain level have to learn how to go through the funding application process in order to get subsidized, because it's kind of a difficult thing to make your way in this society unless you're a celebrity artist. And celebrity artists are maybe 0.1% of all people that claim to be artists, or maybe even less. I mean, you hear about Andy Warhol, but this man is a complete in a level of celebrityhood that is so far beyond a working artist that it's unimaginable, you see. So most of us are obliged to go to our city, our state, or the federal government for funding. If you can't make it, it's very difficult, too, to make it with sales, because people are making the stuff that they're making conceptual art, and what do you do with this? And like this woman, Marina Abramović, you know, going into a museum in New York City and painting words on the wall with cow's blood. I mean, somebody's got to pay for all that. They got to pay for her to come in. They got to pay to clean it up. The whole business, and it's a substantial investment for the Guggenheim or wherever she did her spirit cooking performances. So she's getting some funding probably from private patronage, and then she's also getting it probably from the state, the city of New York. And so my girlfriend, she wanted $4,000 to help this company of trapeze performers put on a show in Seattle. And she went down there to talk to the funding agent, and he said, you have to tool your performance to minorities. Well, in order for her to get the money, she's got to think about the Sikhs, the Somalis, the Eritreans. She's got to think about the Nigerians, and she's got to think about everybody except the people that the theme of the show is about, which was a cult of hippies that disappeared after the 60s and then reemerged in the 2001s and decided to relaunch their career as middle-aged former hippie stars. And this is all for trapeze artists, but that's the story. And these are just white hippie girls, you know, that disappeared and then came back. Kind of like, I can't think of anybody to compare them to, but it would be kind of like Dolly Parton and Emmylou Harris, you know, if they were trapeze artists. So that's the problem with the situation in across America, is this multicultural mandate that you have to have to number one, you know, exhibit your work if you're a visual artist in a gallery. Perform your art on stage if you're a theatrical person. And then if you want to be a poet or a novelist and you need a extra bunch of money to complete a literary project or a, build a website or do whatever they're doing out there that they call making culture, you have to toe this party line, which is totally, it's cultural Marxist. And that is kind of the big problem out there with the people in the profession. But I'll tell you what, there are so few of these culture makers in America that are thinking along the lines that we do that I don't see any kind of a crack in this wall that has been that I watched happen, because I remember in 1995 I was working with a Center on Contemporary Art in Seattle, and all of a sudden for us to be able to get this grant for this nonprofit arts organization that we ran here, we had to start making exhibitions for minorities, for women, homosexuals, and racial minorities. So we, in order to qualify for that annual $10,000 grant that we counted on every year as part, you know, it was like one-fourth of our budget, we had to prove that we were going to bring in these other people, you know, to make sure that they get a fair shake and representation in the arts in Seattle. So we started engineering shows that had to do with, oh, we're going to have the gay show in September. We're going to have the women's show, and that will be in August. And then we'll have the Native American show in, another month. And then we'll have a show for artists. You know what I mean? It all got compartmentalized into these various kinds of communities. And art is art. I mean, it really shouldn't make any difference if you're a male or female, if you're gay or if you're straight, if you're a Native American or if you're a Negro. It should be recognized as art by, I guess, art experts that don't have all this baggage attached to it. But if you've noticed, there's all this baggage attached to the arts in America now, and these grants that are being given and the attention people get in magazines, it has to do with their sexuality, their gender, and their race. And the old white guy like myself is sort of on the outside of the whole scene now, whereas it was just taken for granted when I was becoming an artist. We weren't thinking, well, I'm a white guy and I'm on top of the heap. It was just, I like to make art. And it just happened in those days that I'll tell you another story. Most of the men, you know, in the profession were, most of the artists in the that were professional were men. We had a show at this Coca place, and it was about hot rods. And we were bringing this collection of artifacts from the hot rod culture in Southern California to Seattle, and it was going to be presented at our space. And one of our board members, who was female, said, well, listen, there's no women in this show. What are we going to do about that? And I said, well, there weren't any women pinstriping hot rods in 1947. And she said, can't we bring some women in here? We got to have women, because we're not going to get any money from the government unless we have X number of women in our exhibition. So we went out and we found somebody that sort of did some kind of lowbrow cartoon monster art, you know, a female, and we brought her in. And then there was a big problem with the poster that we did on the backside. It had a gear shift knob that was a shrunken head that they used to sell to car guys, you know, back in the 50s, that with those strings coming out of their mouths and the long hair. Put it on your gear shift knob. And the same girl that was concerned about the lack of females in this exhibition told us, well, these are racist artifacts. And I said, well, they don't even make these anymore. We've lifted a page from an old car custom car magazine and put it into our poster because it reflects the era that we're trying to celebrate, I guess, celebrate or educate. So that's the deal. And I want to tell you too. Pepe was invented here in Seattle, and the guy's name is Matt Fury, and the alt-right stole Pepe from Matt Fury. Matt Fury is represented by a comic book company in Seattle called Fantagraphics. And so Matt Fury and Gary Groth, the head of the publishing company, went to the ADL and started whining like big babies because Pepe got stolen from them. And they're just fit to be tied. They're going, oh, my fucking God, this Pepe is a Nazi frog, and look what they've done to our Pepe. And that was, publicized on the internet, and then it was publicized in this, we have a left-leaning cultural Marxist free newspaper in Seattle that is so typical of the attitude of the Pacific Northwest, as far as the culture here. They were concerned, about the alt-right taking Pepe away from Matt Fury and Fantagraphics, and then to drag the ADL into this thing is, it's just made me sick. So the Frankfurt School are the people that were brought from Germany into the United States. They were precision placed in the academy and the universities by the foundations in America, the Ford, Carnegie, Mellon, all these, these people just have massive amounts of money. And their idea, and you can read the Frankfurt School, you can read Adorno, you can read the others, and the idea was to make art and culture so unharmonious and ugly that it would destroy the culture that preceded it, because these guys are Marxists, and Marxism cannot live alongside of any other ism. It's the second step to communism, or the precursor to communism. So you get into a culture, you start spreading your little Marxist ideas. These guys are theoreticians from Frankfurt, Germany, that were concocted this theory based on Antonio Gramsci, because they couldn't take over Europe by arms, force of arms. So they had to come up with another idea, and the idea was, well, we'll go in through on the long march through the institutions. Institutions are, of course, the universities, the art museums, and these guys had this plan, and the plan was to make all this hideous art. And atonal music from Adorno. I don't know where do these guys get their ideas, because it's resulted in a popular culture, which is at the very top of this popular culture, which is supposed to be intellectual and enlightened and elitist, that you end up with a Marina Abramović painting museum walls with cow's blood and everybody clapping. And thinking there's something profound to this, something extremely occult and witchy and wonderful and edgy and transgressive. It doesn't amount to anything, please. And the Dadaists, when they had their moment, had the honesty to admit that what they were doing meant absolutely nothing. We're Dadaists. Dada means hobby horse. What we do is nothing. We're just making a statement that has been interpreted, if you would like, as anti-war, because that they came up, out of the slaughter of the First World War. But they said, all this stuff that we're throwing together really amounts to nothing but a protest against, cultures that lead their men into the battlefield as cannon fodder. And we don't want to go, and we don't want to die. And that was Dada. And they had the honesty to say, Dada means nothing. Well, after Dada, then you get these other movements, and you get the intellectuals that come along with promoting the movements, and now we've got an art press, we've got art festivals. That's the top of the pops, when you're an artist. If you can be invited to an international arts festival, you get out of school then you get a gallery, maybe, if you're lucky. And then if you do good in the gallery, you get possibly invited to an art fair in a city. If you're noticed at an art fair in a city, you get invited to an art festival in Europe or in South America or in Cuba, you know, these biennales. And that's all locked up, too, with this cultural Marxist mandate, which is egalitarianism, strange kinds of ugly, painting and actions and words and protests about the standard stuff about the oppression of the minorities and colonialism. And if you're from Africa and you can make a statement about how, you know, woe be gone your society is, they'll give you a whole pavilion and you can go ahead and just whine, you know, to whine away. And it starts at the city level, it goes to the state level, it proceeds to the federal level, and then to the international level. And at the very top of the pyramid at the international level, that's a very small cabal, clique of curators and critics who decide, who anoint an artist who then becomes kind of an international celebrity. And they get re-invited year after year to one of these places because their name lends some kind of cachet to this Biennale in, let's say, Brazil. So if you can get if you could get a Marina Abramović to come to Brazil and do one of her spirit cooking gigs, well, then that makes you look like you're very cultural, enlightened, and it's kind of like advertising your country as being a member of this global society that is becoming homogenous wherever you go. You know, if you guys get on airplanes and you take off in every direction for every human being in this room, when you land, you will find the same culture there. And it's really sad because the airports look alike, the museums are starting to look alike, the food is getting, you know, corporatized, and there's a Starbucks in every, like in Paris, you go to your Starbucks, or in downtown Rome, Italy, you pop into a Starbucks, that's all the same. You look at the art, modern art, I'm saying, that is the same. I could go anywhere and find the same, like, dozen artists with the great big paintings in that country, like all those pop guys, you know. And then before the pop guys, we got the abstract expressionists for Americans, and then the European, the British, Damien Hirst and all that. I'm supposed to go in and look at this stupid Damien Hirst spot painting, and I'm supposed to be overawed because it's expensive. Somebody paid a lot of money for it, and that's all it's about, is this Damien Hirst, this painting must have cost $1,500,000, and then you look at it, it spots, right? It's a bunch of colored dots, and you go, wow. And you think because somebody paid that much money for it, that it's good, but not necessarily. So I've discovered that there's that world of elitism and intellectual masturbation that goes along with what you call the fine arts. And then there's the hobby crafts. And I drifted from the fine arts into the hobby crafts when I wanted to learn how to do what I do on china, you know, paint blue flowers on a teacup and make it stay there. And the hobby crafts are what you find at the county fair. And you go to a county fair, and I was there at the Puyallup Fair three weeks ago, and I love going to the damn fair because I like to see what the people that don't have to worry about art, what they do with their hands. And shit, these little ladies are sitting around painting, birdhouses. A little wooden birdhouse, and then they've got their paintbrushes, and they're painting these designs on the birdhouse and making it look. They're doing toll painting. I don't know if you know what that is. There's these pattern paintings that came out of Germany and Scandinavia that are very scrolly. And I'm fascinated by the ease with which these people that don't consider themselves artists can make these objects that are not considered art. They're considered hobbies. And it's kind of their skills that they teach each other. And there used to be more of them, you see, before television. That really killed this the crafts in America and probably everywhere else, because people spent too much time in front of TV and less time in the workshop or less time in the sewing room making things with their hands. So the hobby crafts, I got mass amounts of inspiration from people that don't consider themselves artists. And then when you tell them, you see, I joined a ladies' China painting class so I could learn how to paint on a plate. And these ladies, you know, were just, they thought, boy, we have an artist with us. And then they brought me extra sandwiches at our meetings. And because they thought I was starving, oh, a starving artist. Bring him an extra sandwich. And at the Puyallup Fair, or, you know, when we go, I talk to them because I'm interested in what they're doing and what they're thinking. And then I also like to pull their chains, too. I like to get up there right in their faces and start making comments about what they're doing. But they always say, I'm not an artist. I'm not an artist. And I want to tell them, well, God, you're a better artist than half the people I know that call themselves an artist. And you shouldn't feel like that just because you don't have this machine that creates celebrity artists behind you. I mean, it's you can't tell them that because it's a different world, but I would like to tell them that. So we got the Frankfurt School and the critical theory ruining everything for everybody as far as making beautiful objects go. It all has to be some kind of revolutionary, avant-garde, transgressive. What are we going to do next to épater la bourgeoisie, which means to shock the bourgeoisie? Every year it's got to have more shock value, and every year it gets more and more silly because that's what they think they need to be draw attention to themselves for a career in art, is this shocking value. And then beauty gets set aside. And nobody even talks about beauty anymore. And that's, I believe, what art should have, some element of beauty in it, as well as, I like the idea of craftsmanship, too, because when you look at something and you can see that somebody spent some time thinking about it and then spent some extra time, you know, making it, instead of just tossing it off and putting it there and trying to get you convinced that graffiti is art. It's not art, man. I don't know who these guys think they are. It's just hideous. Have you been pull a train into any major city in the world, and there you've got all this scribbling all over everything, and they encourage this. I was in Slovenia. I went to Ljubljana, Slovenia one year. I came home. I went back the next year. The whole place is covered in this crappy spray-painted tagging. And I said, what's going on here? And they say, well, they think this is self-expression. They're telling the kids it's okay. And it's not okay because it's ruining the architecture underneath it. It just makes it look, the society just looks chaotic, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe you like graffiti, but I don't even like it when they can do it right. I see the great big spray, you know, that Mexicans, you know, the Aztecs with feathers and you know, babes and all that stuff. And it's always got to be about that community, too. You know, you have a great big wall mural, and then there's everybody's, you know, from somewhere in the world, and they're all having fun together, and it's just a bunch of bullshit. They're trying to get us to believe through the arts that the immigrants are assimilating. They're not. You know, we're not holding hands. We're not having fun doing the same things. We might be living, you know, in the same city, but we're all in our little areas, and we all have our own sets of friends and stuff. So, diversity is being completely engineered, and social engineering at the top. And there's a book that, if you guys are interested in what happened, it's called The Cultural Cold War by Francis Stoner Saunders, and this was a CIA operation to make American abstract expressionism the cultural export, and then to promote Americanism everywhere, which is part and parcel of us colonizing the rest of the world with our ridiculously lowbrow culture. I mean, America, Mickey Mouse, you see. I mean, that's everywhere. These movies that we're making, the X-Men and Batman movies, they're drawing mass audiences in China. That's why they make this crap, is because they're exporting American culture, and they got the rest of the world to think that we had this interesting culture because the CIA, who is made up of intellectuals, believe it or not, the CIA is not cloak and dagger so much as social engineering, and they're scientists that understand mass communications and the systems that get people to believe things, and then they proceed to be hired like Edward Bernays and William Burroughs' uncle, Ivy Lee, to go out and convince people that they need stuff that they don't need, or that the stuff that they're looking at in museums is profound, when in fact it is not profound. That happened with the help of these, what we call them, the Kulturbergs. There were three Jewish art critics in the 50s that helped launch abstract expressionism, as well as the CIA, who put it in all the embassies around the world, you know. Had these shows going around. They had intellectuals following it. You can read all about it. But Greenberg, Rosenberg, and Steinberg, that's the Kulturberg. And I have to tell you that what we got here is very Jewish. And the money that buys the art is Jewish. The artists that make the art, a lot of those celebrities, including Marina Abramović, that's one of the reasons why she's where she is. She's half Jewish. She's a Serb. There's that business, you know, this is all kind of intellectual stuff. You can find out a lot about it at the Occidental Review, if you want to pursue it. But it's kind of what happened to America and what happened internationally. The Saatchis, you know, these collectors, these guys have so much money they don't know what to do with, so they decide that they're going to buy, you know, an artist. And once they get picked up by one of these oligarchs, or not necessarily even an oligarch, but just a highfalutin businessman, you know, with extra money to spend on art, then all of a sudden you're anointed as being collectible, and then the next guy wants some of you, and then the next guy wants some of you. And pretty soon, you got a book about yourself, and then another book about yourself, and it goes on and on and on. But I would like to maybe ask you to ask me something, because you mean to go ahead and mock them?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it would really help if you can make them look ridiculous, because that's exactly what they are. The only problem is that can you get the rest of the normies to get the joke? You know, they're so damn stupid, they wouldn't even see it.
Yeah.
I have this one guy that bought two Amy Winehouse teapots because he likes Amy Winehouse. And then I went into his store, and he told me that he was getting phone calls from customers telling him that they didn't like the idea that they had. He said, I had to take your art out of the window because I was getting telephone calls about you. And then he said, is it true that you don't believe in the Holocaust? And I said, yeah, I'm afraid so. And he was shocked, he was crestfallen that what he'd heard from these people that were calling him up to ask him to remove the Amy Winehouse from his store window was true, because he said, oh, I just thought that this was something that they made up to smear you. And I said, absolutely not. I'm a Holocaust denier, sir. Let me tell you about that Amy Winehouse. I didn't want her in the dictator with the rest of the good dictators. But I was collaborating with this guy named Mike Levitt on those, and he said, we got to do Amy Winehouse. And I said, what for? And he said, well, I just like her face, and that, you know, that beehive hairdo. And but it turned out to be okay to do, you know. And she is a wreck, you know, and so is Miley Cyrus and some of these other people they put them forward, I guess, to get the kids to emulate their behavior.
Right.
I mean, this whole heroin chick with Kurt Cobain, you see, and before that, William Burroughs, all of a sudden, everybody's taking heroin because their stars are addicted to it or kind of promoting it through the attention that they get for taking it, you see. And I think that might have been, I'm kind of a conspiracy theorist, I think that might have been engineered too, heroin chick, because I'm convinced that psychedelics were unleashed on my generation biological warfare weapon that was, LSD was developed as that, and then comes into my culture and deracinates all of us, and then the next thing is this, everybody's overdosing on heroin 10 years later. Yeah, that's what I'm finding. You know, I'm finding out, I've been tuning into GnosticMedia.com, and those guys are, they got the paper trail on Aldous Huxley, Tim Leary, Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters, Terrence McKenna, all these guys that we think are visionaries. They're just set up to look like visionaries because they've got an agenda that they're promoting, and the agenda was to get the kids in the 60s to quit protesting the Vietnam War because they had so much money invested in the military-industrial complex, and then to start navel-gazing. So they passed out the LSD, and they told them this is a spiritual experience that you're having. And Tim Leary and these other guys said, yeah, oh, well, you can, this is the quickest way to God. And so that's why I did it. Leary was, hey, man, listen, in order to be a CIA agent, you have to take the Leary examination. It's a personality test that they still have. And they give the guy the potential agent or asset, you know, employee, because not everybody, like I say, CIA is about social engineering, really, a lot about it. But yeah, right. He was a CIA, and he even said as much. Jan Irvin, they've got a movie of all those guys that were involved in MK Ultra having a party at the end of the 60s, patting each other on the back for how they got this idea, how they got it spread out through the culture. I'm really, each week I go back to tune in to see what more, you know, how much more evidence that they've unearthed. It's real fun. And I bought it hook, line, and sinker. I swear to you, I was the biggest hippie on the planet. Oh, I have no, see, that's a good question, and I don't know. Hey, listen, if I'm an example about pro-white art, I think you better hold off on that for a while, because you're going to get chastised. I don't think they're ready for. I mean, in the all-inclusiveness of this diversity that they're promoting, there's no room for whites just yet. Mm-hmm. But that, we might have to go back in as a white artist. After I was always with zine culture, I got involved in subscribing to, before the internet, these, they were called zines. They were little self-published magazines that people sent to other people that were interested in the subjects that they were. And I was interested in, I started getting interested, I was always interested in music, but neo-folk music. And so along with the neo-folk music came a bunch of iconography that looked Third Reich-ish. And I was curious about that, and I discovered Laibach. And I got involved with Laibach in Slovenia through a granting foundation in New York City. They sent me to work with Laibach. I went to Sarajevo, you know, with them during the war and immersed myself in what they call retro avant-gardism, which was their cultural Marxist, I swear to God, theory about what they were doing. And I don't want to get into that, but I realized they're from a Marxist society. They had a nostalgia, post-socialist nostalgia for how they grew up, which was different than us. And so I thought that, well, these guys are really smart because they're, you know, Žižek is their, Slavo Žižek, if any of you know, he's their philosopher for the Neue Slowenische Kunst. It's a collective, and Laibach's the musical arm of it. But I didn't get red-pilled until I went to Romania and started looking into the Iron Guard. And these guys were Christians, and they were prepared to lay their lives down to not lose their culture, because at their universities in the 1920s, 1927, Marxism was leaking into the university, and they realized, I think it's called autochthony. Is that how you pronounce the when a society identifies with its religion? Is that right?
That means native, really. But
autochthony.
Indigenous
culture, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's what the Iron Guardists were wanting to preserve, because they felt, they saw the Russian Revolution and what had happened, you know, nearby, and that kind of fervor, the revolutionary fervor, was spreading through Europe, and that's why Hitler, you know, decided that they had to stop it in Germany, but Romania got a taste of it, that's how I got red-pilled. It was just like, I'm interested in history, and I was interested in this Slovenian avant-garde art group that had a music arm. And then I got interested in Romania, and then I got really interested in the Iron Guard, because they were prepared to die for something, and I can't think of anything I'm prepared to lay my life down for. You know that? And I thought, what kind of a world must it have been where a man would go and sacrifice his life for something he believed. So that's what happened there. Yes. If you could get enough alt-right guys doing the handmade movement. Yeah, no, I was approached by one of the ladies that popularized that and made a movie about it in the book. And so I know that it's going on. And the hobby crafts in that particular milieu are open for hijacking. You see, that's what I did with Delft painting. I hijacked the whole thing. I turned it upside down. And the idea when I started was that you have these prosaic pictures of loaming cows and windmills on place, but I started painting air disasters. And so all these arts, quilt making and whatever you have at the, you guys must have the shows around Christmas time for handmade stuff. You have the makers exhibitions.
Yeah.
Sure, you can go in there and have a whole bunch of fun. But if you do something a little bit, right now you're going to have to slip it by them somehow. You're going to have to outsmart them, because they're not going to be prepared to accept something that like a swastika on anything. Not that you need to put one on.
One comment about graffiti, and it's something I've always found to be kind of odd, is how often people don't see it at all. I went to Milwaukee once, and I was on the main road from the airport. There's this giant mural, And there in the middle of it was a great big picture with a halo of Vang Pao, the great heroin lord of Southeast Asia, allied to the United States. I almost fell out of the car and said to my friend, Vang Pao, Vang Pao. And she didn't know who he was. Nobody knew who he was except for his community, because that's where he lived now. And even worse, I went to Nathan Hale High School here in Seattle for the Democratic or the Republican Party precinct meeting. And they had a gigantic mural of Mexican revolutionaries with sombreros and rifles.
Yeah, I know. Give me a break.
Pointing rifles at the audience. And I was looking at this, and I said to the people at the table, I said, well, what do you think about that mural? And they looked, and they couldn't see it. I said, well, you know, I don't really think Mexican revolutionaries pointing guns at us is appropriate for a Republican Party meeting. And they said to a man, we're not here to talk politics.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, they were pro-McCain.
Well, it's like the kids.
You can't see this stuff.
The Che t-shirt that the kids wear, they get to wear a red star. I mean, that's all de rigueur. Anything with a red star on it or a picture of Che Guevara. Nobody's going to make any bones about that. But try a right-leaning dictator or a figure from the past that was not a communist, or an anti-communist. It doesn't have to be Hitler every time. There's lots of other people. And that's another thing that I like about learning. Listen, there were a bunch of artists and writers who were on the right side of the political spectrum but ended up on the wrong side of history. And you got to go back and find out how many of those types there really were. Because after 45, they cleared the decks on this, and it's just been cultural Marxism from every day since VE Day has been a holiday for the culture, a Marxist holiday for the culture makers of the West. That was it. You know, everybody, Ezra Pound, blip, you're over there, you're down the memory hole. And you got to kind of dig for those guys. Yeah.
Do you not think then that you know, some of these historical characters and other kind of right-leaning symbols, do you think that there's no way to use them? Because like what we've seen working very well is when something becomes extremely taboo, the best way to flip it is kind of to make it funny. And in a way,
yeah,
even with your own artwork, I think was very subversive, especially with that teapot, was because everybody like thought it was funny. And
well, I thought it was funny at first.
The joke ended up being on them. And so in a way, it was like just the whole scenario of the joke being on them ended up, I'm sure, having a major impact. I'm sure, you know, people, that's actually a really good story that you can kind of tell, and it's funny, and that just feeds more into the artwork itself.
Well, to speak to the major impact, I think, and I'm being a shill, but we had a very interesting experience in London where we were threatened, and our gallery was threatened.
Yeah, I forgot to tell you, I got shut down.
To be a cultural figurehead, we're going to need bodyguards. Mm-hmm. For a while. I mean, there's people, it's not just a little teapot with Hitler and everybody laughs at it. It gets a reaction, and that's cool.
Yeah.
It's dangerous.
Well, Charles, I hate to stop this,
okay,
but it's lunchtime and we've got food downstairs.
Let me just tell you one thing.
Yeah.
My latest idea is the Chrysanthemum Circle of Southern Snowmen. And I want everybody to go into the department stores at Christmas and tell the management that their snowmen are too white.